Hey, everybody. That is Gary Smith. That is Kaz Kenny.
Kapow!
And I'm Eddie Bramble, and this is episode 40 of the Blackwater's Edge podcast.
These podcasts are almost as old as I am.
Kaz, why don't you start us off with this week's fish report?
Well, I got to tell you what, man. The fishing has just been absolutely on fire the last 4 days down here. Those of you that got a chance to come down here, you saw it. Those of you that messaged me and followed what I told you to do, you got them. So thank you for coming down. Thank you for keeping a few. And it's pretty much a bait thing. A lot of it was what I've been talking about. MEPS, tip with a minnow. When you look through the page on snakeheadlife.com, pay attention to what the guys are saying they're catching them on. I mean, everybody's using this little minnow trick that I'm talking about. Now, here's something I haven't been talking about. I'm going to go ahead and say it now. I've actually been adding a snakehead destroyer to the back of an 1/8 ounce chatterbait, and the bait is just light enough that I can either slow retrieve that, or I can kind of retrieve it under a bobber real slow. And that was my ticket on Tuesday when you saw me filling the cooler when I was having a bloodbath, was this lure right here. I was getting them on the MEPS and I was getting them on other stuff, but I got to tell you, as soon as I switched to this, and I think the reason that this 1/8 ounce works so good is the spread of the gap. I mean, it's got a nice gap here where a lot of your 1/8 ounce jig heads, they just don't have that gap. It's tight, you know? So,
well, that, and like you said, you can slow retrieve
right.
It.
And for those of you that know Daryl Willie, you know, he can customize and make you some of those crazy, crappy clatters that we were selling last year, them smaller chatter baits. And I was actually using some of them. I got this little technique that I use with those addiction baits, crappy flappers that we sell in the 1/8 ounce. I kind of swing them out, and then I kind of swing them under the bridge, kind of like a pendulum. I don't even reel. I just kind of let it fall next to the pylon real slow, and I'm watching for a tick in that line. I'm just looking for a little, just a slight movement, and I know he's got it, and then just set the hook. I mean, it's that simple. And when they stop biting it with no bait, I just put a little minnow on there, and boom, they're right back on it. So I caught a lot of fish jigging on the backside of pylons on Tuesday. So the tide was going out. I was taking the chatterbait. I was simply just dropping it straight down to the bottom in that calm slack water tight to that pylon. I just pick it up a little bit, and I kind of just swing my rod tip a little bit to the right so it would catch that current coming off the side of the pylon and let the current kind of raise it up real slow off the bottom, if you kind of follow what I'm saying. And let me tell you what, that was just like, I mean, God, man, I didn't even want to leave, man. I had to keep leaving to go get crabs and load crabs. It was like disgusting, man. Like, God, man, I'm leaving these fish biting again, you know? The good thing is every time I went back, they were still there and they were still chewing. So, cool. So I mean, for those of you that got down the last couple of days, you saw Key Wallace. I mean, they caught some big fish. Some people caught some big fish this week. We saw some over 15 here at the store. So, you know, we know they're here. We know that this is the time of the year. You guys hear me say it constantly. I catch my biggest snakeheads in the colder months, just period. I mean, from November until that window starts in March, that's really your best opportune time to get a dragon. And more than likely, it's going to be on bait, you know, 9 times out of 10, I would say, especially when it's really, really cold. Look, I'm not against using bait to catch a dragon. I don't care. You know, and if you're that guy that doesn't want to throw a piece of live bait to catch a dragon, then don't waste your time coming down. But if you're the guy that wants to really up your PB and, you know, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about stuff like that. You know, you want to put stuff on your wall like that. You want to catch things like that. You know, you got to do what we're telling you to do, and you got
Charlotte's
to
was even bigger than that. Charlotte, that one was, I think, 11 pounds. Charlotte's was 13 pounds, and that was on bait. Live bait, just a minnow, that's all.
So, you know, don't be so close-minded that, oh, I'm just, if you don't bite a lure, I'm not going to do it. You know, do like I do, or I don't mean me particularly, I just mean a lot don't of angles like that does. Are being successful, right? a lot of angles that are being successful are really, really going away from what's traditional. You know, I'm going to mention this. I've been actually breaking out some old of my old lures just to see if they work. And there's an old lure called a Pico Perch. It's a metal lure. And it was like one of the first crankbaits that they ever made, you know, back in the day. And I have them where they're balsa, and I also have them where they're metal, and they've got a little metal lip on the front of them, right? So just to see, and it might have just been the fury that was going on, you know, because it was just such a hot bite. I ain't kidding you. I mean, every one of them old lures I was trying to see if they'd catch, they caught, but I forgot one very important thing. They all had old hooks. I don't need to say anymore. So catfish bite is off the hook. For those of you that are over on the bigbluecatlife.com page, you know, look at what Cornflower's doing over there. 60 pounders, 70 pounders, 80 pounders. I mean, That's disgusting.
When does cornflower not catch fish?
When does cornflower sleep? You know what I'm saying? Like, when does he sleep? Because every time I'm looking, he's live on Facebook 2 in the morning, live at Facebook 3 in the morning. There he is out there perch fishing 9 in the morning.
Taking care of his snakes.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's about the fishing report. I mean, there's rockfish, lots of rock. I mean, on the other side of everything, seriously, you know, if you take a ride away from the Snakehead grounds and start hitting some bridges around here, the rockfish bite is on fire. The perch are massive and they're big. The trout that we are catching are 4, 5, 6 pounds. You know, I mean,
tuna bite's not bad either.
Tuna bite's not bad. We're gonna talk about that in just 1 second. Eddie absolutely smoked the tuna, but I mean, we're still catching puppy drum. We're still catching spot. We're still catching small black drum here and
still
there.
Still 70 degrees outside.
Yeah, hot exactly. Damn!
That's exactly right.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about what you did this week. You did something pretty crazy, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to the Outer Banks with my uncle, and we smoked them. Man, we caught 17 yellowfin. We were done fishing by 10:30. We were just absolutely. We had at one point we had 6 rods down at one time. Absolute chaos. I mean, just I was on my knees in one corner of the boat reeling, another guy on his knees in the corner, one guy standing in the back just keeping tension on the line while he's waiting for a chair to open up. Oh, it was just absolute chaos, but it was so much fun. It was a great time.
How many of you guys went?
It was 6 of us that went.
And how many tuna did you guys catch?
17. They weren't real big tuna. After we finished filleting them all up, we ended up with about 20 or 25 pounds of tuna each.
Hold on, man. What did you just say? They weren't what, tuna?
They weren't that big. So.
Whoa, what is our slogan?
That's fair.
25 pounds is enough for anybody.
They can't all be big, but they can all be fun.
Hot damn, baby. That's all I wanted to know. I got that one, didn't I? Mm.
That's the truth. That's how it is, man. Yeah. So, That was a good day. It was a great day, man. It was a lot of fun.
Gary, what about you? Doing any hunting this week? What's been going on with you? Tell us what's going on with you this week.
I haven't done anything this week. I'm busy. Everything. I'm just repairing stuff, man. Everything my wife and I own is either died or broke or being replaced.
Well, how's that trailer?
sad, man. I pulled it. I finally got the tree cut up enough to get it out from underneath it.
For those that didn't see, explain to people what we're talking about when we ask you how your trailer is.
We had, this goes back to the big wind that we had earlier.
Yeah, that was March or April. It was a long time.
We have a hickory tree in our yard. It's about 2 foot in diameter and about 100 feet tall, and it's between two maple trees, and it broke loose on one side and leaned over. I went out there, and there was water all around it, and I'm standing there. The wind's starting to subside some, but there's water around it, and all of a sudden, there's no water there. And then the water blows back up, and then it's gone. And then it blows back. Every time the wind would hit the tree, it would lean over, and all the water would go down in the ground. And then when the tree came back, it'd blow all the water back out. So we got a tree guy out there, and he said, "Nah, it's all right. It'll be fine." Well, it was till this last wind.
Now your trailer's not fine.
Yeah, so now it fell down, kind of crushed the flower bed, plus the flower bed that was around the tree.
Poor Miss Pat.
And she said everything's okay.
I'm going to take her a diet Pepsi.
She said it'll all come back in the spring. I think she's just telling me that because she's going to plant a whole bunch of new stuff.
That's right.
I won't know the difference, thinking. You know. Wishful. Like the kid, when the goldfish dies, you just to flush it and get another one, you know. Plants are plants.
Well, if your wife's anything like me, every time my goldfish died, I got two more. So,
but it landed on top. We have a little trailer that I haul mulch with, and it landed on top of that, and it didn't survive. It's not going to come back in the spring. It's going to get cut up for scrap.
Or we could use it for a piece of structure.
It'd be good for that.
That's what I'm saying. We could paint that thing nice so it doesn't rust in the water. We could drop that thing down there, and that'd be a nice crappy structure down there for us.
I can salvage the receiver off of it and one tire.
And you could probably save some. Pretty much probably save some nuts and bolts for later for something.
That's
right. That's what Uncle Wayne would do. Anytime anything breaks, he save all the hardware, you know.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, how it goes. We've done 2020 pretty much unscathed until like the last month.
You've had a pretty rough week week. I know I had to Uber you one day last week. What happened there?
That was starter on my truck. This week, the water pump went up on it. I'm back on the road again. You know, it's just how it goes. You just got to.
Life on life's terms, man. Right?
Why do you need extra money?
Cornflower, we see you out there, baby. Hey, look, man, you're doing a good job catching them catfish. Keep filling that boat and helping out the Chesapeake Bay. We need you, brother.
That's right.
So that's for me on the fishing report where I'm at. Don't be afraid to drop a line. I always say you don't know if you don't go, so get out there and do it.
That's right. So this week we've got our guest Marnie Pepper. Marnie, how you doing today?
Pretty good. How are y'all?
That's great. So why don't you tell everybody a little about yourself?
Oh, sure. I am project leader or district supervisor for USDA Wildlife Services, and I'm stationed out of the Cambridge office, which is also the Chesapeake Bay Nutria Eradication Project. So that's where I work out of. I also head the Detector Dog Program, which is a really fun program that uses dogs to find or seek out sign of nutria in areas where we're hoping that we're not going to find any.
Marty, let me ask you something. How did this whole nutria thing kind of come about? Let's kind of tell the people, you know, when did we first see them here? When did we first realize we might have an issue with these big rats?
Sure. Well, let's...
Can I call them rats?
Yeah, you can call them rats. Okay. We call them newts or rats. And, well, let's go back in time.
Okay. Let me make sure the flux capacitor is all good.
Do you have sound effects for that?
I'm on the sound for that one, yeah.
Maybe for the next one. So nutria were originally brought into the United States, into Maryland, for their fur. So the idea was that they are pretty hardy animals. They're easy to keep in captivity. And the hope was that you could raise them for the fur market. But unfortunately, their fur is not as a value of as like our native species, like the muskrat. And so there really was no market for them. So what happened was either the animals were released or they escaped from captivity and they ended up in the Chesapeake Bay.
Okay.
And because they have these characteristics that make them really good for captivity, they're disease resistant, they're generalist feeders, they can thrive in the wetlands of the Chesapeake Bay, which is not good for us. Because their feeding habits can be very dangerous. They target the root mat of the plant, and what will happen is they'll feed in one area at a time, and over time, from this feeding, they'll actually increase erosion. And so areas that were once marsh will become these open mudflats or open water areas.
Wow.
And in Blackwater Wildlife Refuge alone, they've lost over 5,000 acres, and that's in part to nutria. Of course, there were other factors that contributed to it, but nutria were one of the main culprits.
Help me understand a little bit, because you know I know when I, you know, I've been coming here a long time, you know, with family and things like that, and I remember that it had gotten so bad they had a bounty. I remember there was like all kinds of crazy stuff going on with that. When did you guys think, hey, we better take some action, we better get something going, we better get something on the ball here, we better see what's going on, you know? And the reason I'm asking that is because I remember younger, you know, coming down here and on some of these areas in Blackwater that I fished, as you would come out of a cut, you didn't have a nice long point there. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have a nice pad field there or something like that. And I noticed, I want to say, you know, this is probably the late 90s, I would say I started to see some things start to change in the refuge, maybe mid-2000s, something like that, I guess. I started to really see I started to see dispersal of some of the pad fields, you know, the late 90s, but by, I would say, like 2003, 2004, somewhere in there, I started to really see.
So, like, the loss of the marsh.
Yeah, yeah. So is that what I was seeing at that time, you know?
It could be. So, in the late 90s, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources partnered with UMES, and they did studies on nutria, because before we could say, okay, well, let's eradicate nutria, we had to answer two very important questions. And one of them was, is the damage you're seeing caused by nutria? And two, if we did remove the nutria, could those areas rebound? And so could the marsh regenerate itself? And what they did was a series of plots out in the marsh. And so it was a lot of work. They actually sectioned off areas with nutria-proof fencing. And then they had other areas that were controlled where nutria could come and go as they pleased. And what they found was that, yes, in areas where nutria could access, those marshes were experiencing, or those plots were experiencing, more damage. In the areas where you could exclude nutria, they were not, and they were able to bound back. And we have some really great photos, if you go to our website, that show areas. We have one where we trapped out some animals on Cod's Point on the chop tank.
What website?
The Chesapeake Bay Nutria Eradication Project.
Okay.
And it shows really clearly, you can see where the animals had been feeding. You can see these areas of open mud, open water.
Wow.
And then within two growing seasons, once those animals have been removed, it rebounds very quickly. Marshes are dynamic systems. They can rebound. The problem that Blackwater experienced was that pressure had been there for so long that the erosion had already kind of broken it down. And so now you had pooling water. And in order to get that marsh back, you'd actually have to bring in material to build it back up.
So help us understand how the marsh is removed by the nutria. It was explained to me, and maybe like I said, I don't know, so that's why we got
there.
So they eat the root system.
And they'll dig it up, and they'll feed in one area at a time. And so you'll come upon an area, and you'll see like a vast open, you know, where obviously something's been grazing and feeding. It almost looks like in some areas like a rototiller coming through.
Like water hogs.
Yeah. Yep.
Kind of reminds me of snakeheads. They find something they want to eat in an area and they eat it.
And they'll keep coming in that area. And slowly you'll see like the development of these little swim channels and trails. And then it just over time increases.
Okay. So as they invade the marsh, I'm just trying to envision in my mind here. So here's the marsh. And here's the nutria. Do they come under the marsh and eat the
roots? No, they're up on the surface. They're up on the surface. Yep.
Okay. But they pull the roots up.
So as they pull the roots,
just like a muskrat,
that loosens the soil and makes it more porous and allows it to kind of wash out.
And you have the tidal fluctuations. Gotcha. And that all accelerates that erosion process.
See, I told you this was going to be awesome today.
Think of it like a hog. So muskrats don't eat roots, right?
They do to an extent, but not to the extent like nutria do. The other thing that you have to consider is nutria don't have any predators. So there's nothing that's really keeping them in check. Also, they have a really rapid reproductive strategy. So a female, once she's 6 months, 5-6 months of age,
sounds like a snakehead again.
Yep. Yeah. Sexually mature. And then she has a gestation of about 130 days. 2 days after she's given birth, she's receptive again.
Wow.
Once that female reaches sexual maturity, she's for the most part pregnant her entire life.
That's crazy.
She's just making
twice a year.
Yeah, at a minimum, you know.
Now, when they were brought here, I know they were brought to some other states, Louisiana and other places. Were they primarily in Maryland, just on the Eastern Shore?
To my knowledge, there may have been some on the Western Shore, but those populations never took hold. The problem here is because of the environment, the conditions allowed them to really capitalize on the wetlands that they were here. And so they became a huge problem.
So it sounds kind of like the same thing as a snakehead, the perfect storm.
Snakehead with fur, yes. Yeah. I just mean
the whole setup, you know, it's like the perfect storm, kind of like with the nutria and the snakehead. I'll tell you what I'm learning from this so far today. I'm learning how a different angle to look at this whole snakehead thing. Mm-hmm. And the two questions that she said that they were asked.
We ask all the time.
Ask myself this. I mean, anybody out there, ask yourself that same question about snakeheads. You know, do you think it's a direct result of snakeheads? And that's one of the things we're trying to figure out here. You know, we don't want to blame the snakeheads, you know, but we know we can blame the nutria.
No. Yep. And there's a lot of other processes that are going on. But, you know, in the case of the snakehead or in the case of the nutria, it may be that straw that breaks the camel's back.
It just brings it right over the edge.
Right. And because it was such a huge problem, I mean, you look at the Chesapeake Bay, you look at the wetlands and the habitats here, there's a lot of value. There's economic value. There's ecological value.
Resource value.
And to take on the challenge of eradicating a rodent is monumental. So not any one agency could take that on.
That's what kind of I was thinking about, because you look at like the pesticide companies, or whatever you call them, that come in and like maintain apartments and things like that. You know, I talk to a lot of them guys, and a lot of them guys tell me, you know, it's repetitive business because we never get rid of them.
It's very difficult.
So to hear that, you know, you guys were able to be successful in eradication.
We're not eradicated yet. We're close, but not quite. We can't really say that yet because we're in the final phases where we're verifying it. But the important thing is, you know, as I said, it's a monumental task to take on eradication. And that's why not one agency could do it. And we're a collaboration of multiple agencies. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is our biggest supporter. They provide the financial means to do the work that we do.
Very good.
We also cooperate with Maryland Department of Natural Resources. They provide support as well. And my agency, USDA Wildlife Services, we do the on-the-ground work. So we're out there doing the operations, but we all meet and talk together, and we all have different skill sets and backgrounds to bring to the table, and that's what makes it successful, because we're all using our strengths.
I want to bring that up, you know, the fact that to look at how all these organizations interact with one another, like I never really realized that it was this extensive, you know, and as we're doing these podcasts and meeting people, I'm really seeing the expansiveness of what is involved here, you know?
One thing about the nutria versus the snakeheads, I guess the way I see it is snakeheads are impacting a lot of other species besides themselves.
Directly, because they're feeding on them.
And besides the erosion to the ground, the nutrias didn't really affect any other species?
Well,
I guess maybe muskrats
indirectly,
a little bit.
Because you think about
that would be my question.
They take away, so, you know, let's say they feed 5,000 acres of marsh has been lost.
And say those butterflies utilize that area.
Butterflies, you got seaside sparrows, you got coastal plain swamp sparrows, your rail species. You have a lot of species that are what we call obligate wetland species, that they require that particular habitat to exist in. So when it's not there, they can't exist.
So let's call this the beneath the surface stuff, because, you know, people always see above the surface, and now we're talking about below the surface. So because of these nutria impacting these 5,000 acres, there's a domino effect that's created simply by this animal with other species directly related to the way that they're eating the marsh. So if
everything's connected.
Yep, I get it. So if you're removing that, you're taking food from something else.
Anytime you add or take away, you're having some type of impact, and maybe it's an impact that's acceptable, maybe it's an impact that's not acceptable. And that's, but there's always something.
God, doesn't that make sense? Like, the impact of snakeheads in some places is acceptable to places. And you know what I mean?
It's an almost identical scenario.
This is cool.
It's crazy how this is almost identical to the way snakeheads
come. And you'll see that across. It is a common thread with invasive species. They tend to be high reproduction. They tend not to have a lot of predators. They tend to be fairly disease resistant. You know, there's a lot of very common threads between your successful invasive species.
The nutrias, they don't build a nest.
Not like a muskrat with a house. No, they'll get up on muskrat houses, especially when the marsh floods. And a lot of times what we'll do is when we're walking through the marsh, we'll check muskrat houses because it is an area that they'll come up on.
But that's one of the biggest factors in being able to get rid of them is the fact that they don't have a place to hide.
Right, and they will make beds.
Right.
But it's nothing like a muskrat. It's just basically they flop vegetation over and they'll lay on it.
So sit
on it and groom.
I meant the eradication. So we don't want to use that word, right? So we know we're not eradicated. We're saying completely.
That's the mission. The mission or our goal is to eradicate nutria from all of Delmarva. And right now we haven't had a detection since
that was 2015.
That's an actual animal in hand or confirmed nutria.
And that was in the refuge?
No, the last...
That was what I wanted to ask you. When is the last time that we saw him in the refuge that's documented that you
documented, captured animal was 2011. It was December of 2011, almost, yeah.
9 years.
And
9 years, man. That's doing something.
The very last one was caught on the Wicomico River, and that was in May of 2015.
So still 5 years, you know. I mean that's a pretty good program, I'd say, you know.
And we didn't know at the time when we had that last nutria on the Wicomico, and it was actually a situation where we found a pocket of nutria. We had a bunch of new employees come on, and we're like, great, this is a perfect teaching opportunity. We'll take them out to this marsh. They can set some traps. They can learn sign. They can see what to look for. And one of the specialists, she set a trap. It took her, you know, she set it all nice and neat. And it ended up being the last recorded nutria we had. So she said, one and done. I did it. You're welcome.
So how about in
but
Delaware?
We had no idea at the time.
But in Delaware, are they in Delaware?
Not that we know of. We are looking in Delaware now. We have been looking in Delaware. The last known population was in Mud Mill, and I believe that was around 2012. But I'd have to check that one.
I want to ask because I know that you have some workings with the dogs and all that. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that. So originally, let's talk about how dogs came into play with this program and what they were used for. I know you said something about scat detection, and I want to get to a place where at the end of this, I guess my question is going to be, after you explain that, is have the dogs alerted to any scat here in the last year or two? But let's talk about the dogs, how we started with that and how we moved to the other side. You were explaining to me earlier from the original thing or whatever.
So in the beginning, and if you look at like some of the old field journals, you'll see folks like to go out. If it was like a nice cold January, they would take a dog and they'd go out and they would nutria hunt. And you know, that was something that you could do and have a good afternoon and who knows, maybe catch 70 animals.
Yeah, no limit.
Yeah, there was no limit. And they're actually not bad to eat. So you know,
ate it?
Yes. Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, I probably offend some people here, but it's better than muskrat.
Hey, uh-oh.
I know, I'm sorry. Oh, wow. I know.
That doesn't mean bring the nutria back.
No. Certainly no. No, it is not something that you're going, you know, there is a lot of prep work in it. It's not something that I think is going to ever take off. But,
so 10 days, salt, cookboard, yeah, eat board.
Eat board, yep. No, it is not bad. And in Louisiana, they try to tout it as table fare, as sort of an exotic table fare. It is not very strong. But again, it's not, you know, something that most people are probably going to want to eat. So, because at the end of the day, it does look like a giant rat.
So what's the main difference between here and Louisiana, where we've been more successful with eradicating them here?
Well, so one of the criteria for eradication is you have to be able to prevent any type of reinvasion or immigration from another area. And so when you look at Louisiana, all the Gulf Coast has nutria. Right. So you're looking at a very large area that you would have to remove them from. And it's just not feasible. And it may not necessarily be the way to go in that situation. You know, where we are, you have a northern boundary because at least up until recent, we had winters and, you know, they would...
Right, not this year.
Yeah, this year. And this would be horrible conditions if we had nutria because everything's flooded. So that creates connectivity and, you know, lots of things. Your snakeheads are probably moving around to a different area. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, this is a bad situation. But from the Delmarva Peninsula standpoint, we are, in a sense, an island because we have the Chesapeake Bay as a barrier to the south, and then further north, they're not going to exist in those conditions.
Because the climate too cold? Is that
it's
why?
It's too cold, okay. Yeah. It's too cold. And so, you know, in that sense, you can control, there's nobody coming in. And that way, it allows you to put every individual at risk, and there's not that chance that somebody else is going to come and repopulate the area.
So the dog idea, I guess, that came from the hunting stuff that they do in Louisiana. Is that how you guys kind of got that idea?
No, I think they were doing it here. I think folks would do it recreationally. Okay. Some guys on the project asked if they could bring their personal dogs in to help bay nutria. And so they said, okay, well, let's give it a try and see if this works. And they brought in their labs or their Chesapeakes or whatever they had. We've had everything from Rottweilers to lab mixes to Beagle that would come.
I think a Beagle would do good.
Yeah, you would think, you know. And so they would go out in the marsh, and because nutria were so plentiful in the landscape, it was not hard to train a dog to seek out that particular animal because it was the most common thing he was going to find. And it was, you know, a lot of fun for the dog because they would bay it. That then the handler could come and take care of it, and you could remove a lot of animals in a short period of time, and it became very useful in sites where you had low densities. So you may only have a few animals bouncing around. You could set traps, and that would certainly work, but it might take 2 weeks or right. so. You could come in with the dogs on a good afternoon and maybe wrap it up in an afternoon, and so it was just a lot more efficient.
So with the dogs... Are the guys shooting them, or are the dogs getting them and bringing them back?
No, the dogs wouldn't get them and bring them back. They would be euthanized via firearm.
Okay.
So when we progressed in the eradication, so, you know, I said it's been 5 years since we've had hands on a nutria, you know, it'd be very hard to reinforce that with a dog because the whole reward for the dog is to chase that nutria. Right. You know, that's a chasing, baying, 5 years you haven't chased or bayed anything, you're going to start getting bored and you're going to start looking for things to chase and bay. And
use it or lose it.
Yep.
You're going to start having dogs that have never seen a nutria.
Exactly. Right. And that became the problem. And so we tried to work around it. Well, how can we reinforce this? And, you know, could you use a hide? You just couldn't. And so
train them in Louisiana.
Yeah. Oh, trust me, that came up multiple times that we needed to take trips to the Louisiana.
Carl just wanted to go to Louisiana. Yep.
You nailed it.
Alligators are biting. We got to go to Louisiana to catch nutria.
I'm going to bust his chops when I go get my deer.
Oh, he's been asking to go to Louisiana, Alabama, anywhere down there.
I think my steaks just got ground in the hamburger.
Where they're getting sold to me for half price.
You just lost it. So we knew, okay, well, we knew that canines were a valuable resource on the project, and we didn't want to lose that resource, but it had to adapt to the changing needs of the project. And that's when we reached out. with the National Detector Dog Training Center. And that's a APHIS program, so Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, under the USDA. And what they do is they train your agriculture detection dogs. So if you've been to the airport, you've seen the Beagle Brigade, the little beagles that check your luggage. Mm-hmm. Those are the dogs that they're training. They're training dogs at border cargo, to get any type of produce that might be coming into the states that shouldn't be, that needs to be checked. And they do some work for Fish and Wildlife where they were doing like wildlife contraband, but they had never done something quite like this. And so you can imagine the fun conversation where we called them up and like, okay, well, we want to train dogs. What do you want to train them to do? Well, to find nutria poop.
Big feature in that.
Yep. And
funk.
But from a training standpoint, you know, you have these dogs, they're toy driven. So it's a different training process than it would be for like a hunting dog, because there's not sort of that natural instinct that you're relying on. You've got to train the dog, this new association that, hey, we're going to go out, we're going to look for nutria scat. And when you find it, you're going to bark. And when you do, we're going to play with your favorite toy. And that's what, you know, these dogs are toy obsessed. And for them, this is just one big game. And on the flip side, from the employee standpoint, it's also kind of jazzes up the employee, because you think, you know, you're looking for these animals, you're not finding them. And now you've got a partner who's just happy, happy. It's Monday. Yay, I get to go to work. You know, that helps with employee morale, too. You know, to have a partner that's excited to go to work and go out there in the field.
That's very, very, very awesome.
So what we do is we do carry nutria poop with us. We have
you have it in your pocket right now?
No. Okay, good. And I will tell
and
you,
it must be you over there smelling like that. No, I'm just kidding.
No, it's all freeze dried.
Oh, we have two freezers that are full of nutria scat samples, and we carry them out there with us. And yes, everyone probably has at least once forgot a sample that you do it one time.
It only takes once,
and then you check your pockets from then all out.
That's probably about the strangest thing, getting imported from Louisiana.
Yeah, I was about to say, is that how you get the scat that all comes from Louisiana, or how do you get that?
We actually had for a number of years captive animals, and we were using them for some different research projects. One of the earliest ones was what we called the Judas Nutria Project.
Tell us about that.
And this is where we took nutria. Nutria is semi-gregarious. That means they like to be around other nutria. And what we did was we took animals from the wild, we sterilized them so that they couldn't reproduce, and then we put radio collars on them. And the idea was, you radio collared this animal, you released him back into the environment, and he's going to go seek out other nutria that are there. And when, you know, you follow him around, and when he stops in a particular marsh, you can find other nutria.
They're putting your second crappie on a bobber.
or your right female snakehead and letting it swim around out there in the middle.
That's pretty cool.
Yep.
It is, man.
And it's not a concept that we came up with. They use it on other species, goats, pigs, you know, where
I think I've heard this before with hogs down south.
Yep. So it's just basically capitalizing on a natural behavior that these animals have, and that allows us to be more effective at detecting them.
What other, have you guys done any other kinds of like top secret projects like that?
It's not top secret.
I know, drama. We need drama.
That's not a secret now.
The reports all lied. We have cross-trained our dogs on feral swine or wild pig scat. And although we don't have like established population of pigs in Maryland, there are occasionally sightings, but it's not like when you go down south and you have...
I was going to ask that question next, because I've had a couple people this year ask me if I've heard anything about wild pigs here in the marsh.
Well, there were some on Taylor's Island, I think it was 2 years ago.
Several years. Yeah. Well, it's probably been longer than that now. Yeah, maybe longer. Yeah, now, yeah. But those were removed.
Were you guys a part of that?
It was a group of agencies again, because it's sort of, we didn't want that to get out. You know, right. You didn't want...
So what happened there? Let's hear that story. What was that about, the hogs on Taylor's Island? Can you tell us anything about that?
So they had a person who had pigs, and they were not contained, and they escaped out into the environment. And so they were opportunistically removed when they could be.
So were they reproducing out in the wild? Is that what's going on?
I don't know if they got to that point. I don't, because again, we were just doing the monitoring. Right. But I believe the idea was they wanted to catch them before that happened.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you tell us anything about coyotes in Dorchester County? Do you know anything about that? Because we've been getting a lot of that lately. You know, a lot of guys have been asking us about coyotes and stuff here in the refuge, and you know,
they're there. I don't know. Again, you know, they're there. And it seems to be certainly in different areas you're getting more activity.
Are you guys doing anything with coyotes or anything like that?
We don't. Again, unless it was an issue, our agency does handle situations where there's like livestock issues, but that's typically out west where they have more problem with coyotes.
Gotcha. I just had a lot of guys here lately. I'm hearing coyotes. Well,
it's hunting season, so people are out and about. I mean, we have them in Delaware, but they're very few and far between. I can remember the first one we got on trail camera, and I was like, oh, you know, they're here. You know, we're seeing coyotes. But then it's been sporadic for the last 8 years now.
So somebody shot a monster one up giant in Roosburg. The other day. I mean, a big coyote.
Was that the one that looked like a wolf? Shepherd.
Yeah, it looked like a wolf, man. That's what I thought.
Well, I think wolf. Part of them were part wolf, like a hybrid, coyote wolf hybrids.
I don't know. That was a big bash.
No, this past summer I had the opportunity to take Marsha Prentice out on the Blackwater River.
Okay. And
if you go in the back, probably most people that kayak would have went in from Parsons Creek. But if you go back right past the weir, the creek goes pretty straight, and then it makes a turn. And right on the corner of that turn, there was a little box about 2 foot square. And I always saw those out in the marsh and thought that they were boxes they put out for geese to build a nest on. But this was a brand new one.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a little U.S. something or other sign, you know, little emblem thing on a post. Yeah, maybe. And Marsha said that they set those out because Newt said they're there. We'll get up on that box and poop, and then you come by and scoop the poop.
Yep,
you know he's there.
Identify, yeah. So we have monitoring platforms that we have all through the Chop Tank, the Wicomico, the Blackwater. You'll see them. They're just a 2x2 floating raft, and they're designed so.
I just learned something.
So if you see one, don't mess with it.
No. All it is, it doesn't trap the animal or hurt the animal. Right. All they do is they'll climb up on them and they'll sit there and groom because it's a nice, you know, area that they can get out of the water. You know, we from field observations noticed that they would do that on different structures. They especially duck blinds. They would climb up and you would see nutria scat all on the boards that were out there. And so one of the specialists on the program said, well, why don't we create that? And then that way we can control that and we can put them where we want them. And so we have monitoring lines that we check of these platforms. Now we have hair snares on them. So you'll see it almost looks like what you use to catch squid. There's like little umbrella hook. Mm-hmm. And it's just a piece of aircraft cable that's been frayed and put into like an umbrella shape. And it hangs down and all it does is it grabs a little bit of their back hair. And when we go and check them, we'll see, oh, there's hair in this sample. So we'll take it out, we'll put it in a little plastic test tube. And then we'll take it back to our office, and then we can look at the hair structure and say, okay, well, this is a raccoon or this is a nutria. And that will allow us to kind of have some way of detecting them without having a lot of effort into it.
In case you don't have any dogs.
I just learned a lot because there's a few of these little squares that I've seen over Maple Dam and things like that.
And you've been
like
sinking them and you're...
No. I've been thinking, why do they have these boxes so close to the road? No duck's going to nest in this thing at all. Dude, no. I wouldn't because it, you know.
But well, a nutria might climb up.
So now I know
that was my purpose of mentioning that because you see them out
good
there.
Point,
and, you know, don't mess with them. They're there for a reason.
And if you have one, someone told me the other day, oh well, there's one right next to my duck blind. Hey, we'll move it. It's not we're not trying to interfere with anything. We'll certainly move it.
Somebody's always going to complain.
Oh yeah,
no matter what you do, we've learned that. Marnie, I want to talk a little bit about. Let's talk about Marnie. Let's get away from Nutri. Let's talk about what you like to do. I know you told me before the show that we were talking about hunting and things like that.
Yep.
So let's talk about your background in the great outdoors. What does Marnie like to do when she's not at work?
Well, and I think that is something for people that get into the wildlife field, you know, there's a very not a defined boundary between work and play. You know, a lot of the stuff we do at work, we enjoy doing. And that's why, you know, we go into that discipline. And I enjoy, you know, I have my detector dog that has been retired. She tore her ACL, so she couldn't be put back into work. But she could recover from that injury, and she came home and needed, you know, something to kind of keep her mind active, because she's a very high energy dog. And so what we like to do is go look for shed antlers. I trained her on shed antlers and turtles. Because, you know, you could, two things that you hopefully can find in the environment. And so, you know, we'll go out and we'll do surveys, but instead of looking for nutria poop, we're looking for antlers. And that's a fun pastime. Also, like we talked about hunting, I got into deer hunting late. As I said, I didn't grow up doing it. I started doing it.
What interests you that made you want to go do
deer hunting? I don't know that I could even define that. It's one of those, you know, it's sort of like, for whatever reason, I've always been sort of obsessed with catching things. And I know that's not catching things, but it's always that seeking and finding.
Right.
You know, growing up, I caught minnows and grass shrimp and butterflies. And yeah, whatever you could, you know, whatever couldn't get away from you. And, you know, I always thought about deer hunting. I loved eating deer meat, and it was always a treat when somebody would bring over venison, and it was always like, oh, we're going to have venison tonight. You know, this is a treat, because it wasn't something that we typically got. And so I think those things kind of all came together, to kind of create that interest. And then also, I like climbing trees. You know, it's kind of neat. You get to go sit up in a tree. I mean, who wouldn't like that?
I can relate to that.
Yeah. Right. You can get away from everything. You're up in a tree. I will say I'm a little bit of a bird nerd. So, you know, for me, I can sit up there and I can watch the birds and, you know, see different species. And a lot of the things that you can see, you know, you're not going to experience just walking or hiking or anything. It's sitting there, taking time, being quiet, hopefully, and watching things live their lives. Marsha posted a video of a box turtle she saw from her stand. And that's like the coolest thing. You know, you're sitting there, you hear something, you look down, and there's a turtle walking, you know, doing his turtle thing, going across the lane.
I like just the fact that when you're, especially if you're way out in the marsh somewhere where a lot of people don't go.
Yes.
The animals don't really pay a whole lot of attention to you, especially birds. You know, they'll land. I've had them land on my shooting rail.
Yeah.
I had it happen a couple of weeks ago. I had a little Jenny Wren. It landed right on my shooting rail. Just kind of stayed there about 5 minutes. And they're real quick anyway. Give me the.
I was hunting one time over on Button's Neck in an open stand. And there was a barred owl that was sitting up here. And I had full camo, everything. The only thing that you could see were my eyes. And I kind of lift the flap up that was covering my eyeballs just so I could see watch the owl, you know, because it was just beautiful. And I'm like, I'm looking at it, and it keeps turning its head like this. Turns its head like this, and it's hopping down looking at me. I'm like, what the hell is it doing? All of a sudden, the son of a gun took off right from my face. I swear to God, it opened its, it put its claws like this, like it was coming to my face. I think it thought my eyeballs were something, seriously. I went, whoa! I swear the thing, when it went to back pedal, it just dropped out of the sky, man. It just hit the ground and like looked up at me like, what the hell was that? And it took off. Dude.
It's all your eyes, maybe, with those little mouse climbing a tree.
I don't know, but I get it, man, and I think people out there get it. Yeah. So I know you said that you weren't very successful your first time. So tell us about some of the hunts before you were able to make something happen.
Yes, it was a
mistakes.
Lot of,
we all yeah, make mistakes. Yep, is there any mistakes that you remember, like, damn it? To this day, you know what I mean?
Watching the wind. That was always, you know, because it doesn't matter what you do. They can smell you.
You're going to get winded.
If you try, you know, obviously try to do everything you can to avoid smelling too strongly. But at the end of the day, if they're downwind from you, they're gonna pick up on you.
Before I get to my next question, we all love America, and America needs to love each other right now. So, look, if you want to get this snakeheadlife.com sticker, I need you to write "I love America" in the content comments, and you get that. So, tell us about your first deer that you shot. Tell us that story, because I kind of like that when you were telling us.
Well, yeah, and again, you know, there just was an opportunity to hunt, and I finally said, you know what, I want to hunt. And I asked my husband, I said, do you care if I hunt on the farm? And he said, no, have at it. You know, he hunted a little bit, but it wasn't anything, you know, now looking back, I mean, we're passionate about deer hunting. We do habitat manipulations. We got trail cams every, you know, this is what we do. This is what we enjoy. But at that time, you know, we were still very young into different things. And I really didn't know really where to even start. I knew a lot of the book knowledge, but you can read all the books in the world until you go out there and do that. You really truly don't learn.
I agree.
And so for the first, I went out and it took about 2 years. I made a lot of mistakes. And then finally in that second, just about second year, deer made a mistake. And it was a doe. She had come out and I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. And I better get prepared. And she came behind a tree and I said, okay, well, as soon as she comes, you know, I got, while she was out of sight, I hurry up and got positioned. And I said, as soon as she comes from behind that tree, I'm going to take the shot. And I took the shot and she ran. And I had never, ever, you know, been with anybody shooting a deer. I didn't know what to expect, what would happen. And I thought, I missed. All these years,
all this practice,
all this, and I finally had my one opportunity and I blew it. And I, you know, I didn't really know exactly what to do. So I was like, well, I should look for blood. And I went out to where she was and I didn't see anything. And I thought, man, I really missed. And I was like, this couldn't have been 30 yards. Wow. I really need to practice, and, you know. And then I looked down the way she ran. And I could tell that, no, there was a blood trail. I just needed to look a little bit further and finally got, you know, my hands on my first deer. And it was, you know, just a great experience. And from then, it just snowballed from there. After the second year, I think I said to my husband, I was like, I need a bow. And he's like, you need a bow? I was like, yes. He's like, why do you need a bow? I was like, because bow season is, you know, the whole several months. And now, you know, like I said, we're both very into it. He is, good. You know, his interest is more in the habitat management. He loves to hunt, deer hunt as well, but he comes from a farming background, and so he knows all the plantings, and you know, he knows how to grow things. And
he knows what kind of rack woods to put out there, what kind of salt block. Now,
I know one thing. I'm gonna your little comment about you can read all the books and go. I'm going to share this with all the architects and engineers that I know.
Because you guys read lots of books, don't you? God, I've learned that working with you. So.
Yeah. Yep, and you can certainly learn a lot that way, but I think, you know, the experience, if you can get that and the experience, that's what's
really I think what you're talking about is two different things, you know. Time takes time. Mm-hmm. And that's very – I'm really, really glad that you shared that story because – how many guys out there I know personally that, you know, I've been hunting this long, I still haven't killed a deer, I'm ready to quit. You know, a lot of times it doesn't happen your first or second time. You know, a lot of times it takes time. I mean, I know guys have been coming down here Snakehead for 5 years that still have yet to catch more than 20 fish in a day. You know, so.
Well, I think that's what's made the first shot program so successful.
Yes.
Is you get to have the vast wealth of knowledge from an experienced hunter to help a beginner out that doesn't even know where to start a lot of times. It's been a big success for them.
And seeing the success of that really has me fired up for this new first cast.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be awesome.
I mean, I think that we're going to be able to do something really, really big with this, with everybody, you know, and it's going to be so exciting, you know. I mean, I can't wait to just take that next step, you know. Before I forget, you know, I love Maryland, and if you love Maryland, you need to write "I love Maryland" in the comments right now, and you can have that sticker.
Jason, you've got the first one too.
Yeah, you got that one. Marnie, let's talk about fishing. You like to do fishing at all? You go fishing?
A little bit.
Not as much anymore.
I did a lot when I was growing up. Like I said,
so you kind of flip flopped then. You kind of went from fishing.
I did. My brother stuck with it. I mean, because like I said, my family was very much into fishing. I spent a lot of time on a boat in Indian River, Rehoboth Bay. It was mostly saltwater fishing. And we did, you know, Dad gravitated towards fishing versus hunting because it was something like the whole family could do together. And you could do it practically all year round.
Did you talk fish?
A little bit. Yep, a little bit. And we would make bucktails. And I don't know if that's the correct, you know, is what we call bucktails. So, you know, we were getting the deer tails from all the hunters and we would have them all, you know, tacked out. That's and drying cool. And so I learned how to tie bucktails. We would pour molds in the basement and, you know, paint.
You've just done it all, man.
I think, awesome. I think how many people poured molds in their basement? Hot lead.
Yeah. Oh, I did. I just cleaned them up. I didn't get. Yeah. They didn't trust me with the pouring.
No,
part.
But you know, I mean, you don't heat lead in a confined space.
No.
And everybody did it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what,
in the basement.
That's what killed the Romans.
Yeah.
But so many people had little shops and stuff, you know, and they probably still do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure.
Pouring lead in a confined space is not a good thing.
My brother used to tie rods, so, you know, and we spent a lot of time in the bait shops and learned a lot sitting on a bait cooler.
So what else do you hunt besides deer?
I've turkey hunt a little bit, squirrel hunt, but mostly it's deer. Turkey hunting is, I've gotten into a little bit more, but it's definitely a little bit more challenging, I think.
Yeah, I like turkey hunting, but I get busted, too.
You can't sit still.
I know, that's what I'm telling. That's why I don't like it, man. I mean,
yeah, you're talking about that owl. Yeah. Old turkey, you can understand completely.
Hey, I will tell you what. I did. I froze up when that thing was there. I was like, whoa. I'm not moving. Look at that.
Did your life flash before your eyes?
No, but I mean, I literally saw the talons, like, and it was like, it was pretty dark. Like, it was still, you know, still had shooting light. You know, I could see that, but I remember looking up and it was like, good God, look at them claws. Hey! You know? I was like, God dang. We all like catching snakeheads. So I like catching snakeheads. You can get that realistic sticker. Put that in the comments. I like catching snakeheads.
Brian, you've got the Maryland sticker.
Yeah, we can't give it to you, Pat. So, we've talked about fishing, we've talked about hunting, we've talked about nutria. What else is there that we need to know? Anything else?
Well, if there's anybody listening that does have any nutria sightings, as I said, we're not at the point where we feel comfortable declaring eradication. We still have a lot of areas where we need to look. We've covered the watersheds that historically had nutria in them. And now we're kind of branching out. One of the areas we're focusing on now is around the Pocomoke, Snow Hill area, looking in those areas because there have been historically sign of nutria, but there never was populations like we found in the other watersheds.
So, you like crabbing?
Yes. Yep. I grew up crabbing and clamming.
You've had to do some crabbing here this summer, right?
I don't do a ton because I live over in Delaware. So the crabbing that we do would be over there. And we didn't really do the trout lining until I started working in Maryland. We always just did the hand lining.
Now, you know, you're at Key Wireless. You can just go hang some strings off the bridge and you can fill a couple bushels there if you hang out for a couple, 2 or 3 hours. You know that, right? I guess I don't know. I don't really have much more that I have to ask.
We've got our MEPS angle of the week.
We need to talk about our MEPS angle of the week. Before we get into that, I do want to talk about a couple baits.
Okay.
Gary wants to talk about some of Daryl's addiction baits today and see what we got going on there.
I thought old Daryl left town, man. Apparently not.
I got a private stash nobody knows about.
You guys come in here tonight and lit me up.
So the reason we're showing you these are some of the other baits that have been successful here in the last couple of weeks with the snakeheads when they've turned on. That toad chatter, I know some guys
they've
the other day.
They've
been catching a lot this week on that, you know. So I don't know if it's the whole frog thing or what.
I think it's the combination of that chatter along with the double tail action makes a big difference.
I think the color, that hot pink's pretty hot, you know. Nice. All them bright colors seem to work good this week, you know. What else you got over there, Gary?
Water's muddy. You can see them.
That's a beautiful lure.
And catching them on that.
Yeah.
And chatter baits.
Yeah, my favorites. Chatters and splatters.
Gary, did you have a splatter there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's
first thing I held up.
Yeah, that's he was downstairs. Yeah, he was like, oh, my God, where'd you get them from?
Yeah, he's going in the water tomorrow.
And then he took it out of the package and was like, can I take a set? So he showed it.
Yeah, we can't resell it now. Packing
that. The guy knows about the package. He can just take it home, right? He was getting ready to do it with the other one, but we stopped him on that. No, I'm just kidding. Look, don't overlook a 3-inch white twister tail right now on just a jig head. Just throwing it out and reeling it in.
Right on the back of that.
Yep, you can put it on that too. And the elastics, you know, they're still catching some good fish on these smaller elastics.
I love those.
I know
things.
A lot of people do. The bait right now, predominantly that they're eating on these shad, are about 3 inches. You know, some of them are 4 inches. Then you've got some of the bigger mud shad that are here. So they're about 6 to 8 inches that they're eating on right now. So this three inch bait right here with this little spinner pretty much matches the size of the shad right now we got going on. One more thing, I don't want to forget the Z-Man, the 8th-ounce chatter, man. If you're out next week and you're fishing, look, this rain that we just had was 60-degree rain, so it's not like it really inhibited the water that much. It may be a little muddy today. but I think we're going to clear up by tomorrow. And if you're out and riding around tonight and the road's flooded, put your fog lights on so you can see down low. Keep a net hanging out the window and scoop as you go.
And
so,
keep your gig with you.
That's right. Keep your gig there, too. Marnie, this has been so awesome today. I think that people today really learned something. I know I did. I hope everybody. I mean, I think you two did. I mean, I know you guys know it all like me, too, you know. So, no, I'm just kidding. But, no, I think this was a really good show, and I think the public really, really got a lot out of all this. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I appreciate y'all having me.
Well, thank you.
So, Marnie, I told you, I want you to think of who we can ask over there for a show, and we'll get back to somebody. So think about who over there you want to throw under the bus and send them over to us.
Okay? Oh, I can probably do multiple then.
Well, we can do multiple guests. Yeah. I mean, we could rotate them on the hour, man.
So this week's MEPS Angler of the Week, we've got James Stevenson. He put this picture on snakeheadlife.com, and... Man, he's got a pile there.
That was a good day there.
That's a good day right there.
And for those of you, MEPS.
Always MEPS.
MEPS with the Snakehead Destroyer, baby. I'll tell you what, I was really happy to see a lot of the posts that we saw this week, and it seemed like a lot of people were successful. Even the people that didn't put a post up that I talked to, most everybody that I talked to that came down the last 4 days left with at least five or so fish, and a few of them left with 50 plus. So... I know one guy called me up. He said, man, I'm catching so many. Can I give you some? I said, I'll be happy to take whatever you don't want. He said, I can't get any more in my cooler. I said, where you at? I'll be right over there to get them. So,
Hopefully it's going to cool down this weekend a little bit. Maybe Gary, deer will come around.
What are you thinking the rut thing? What do you think with the rut? You think this heat slowed them down a little bit or what?
Because I haven't been whitetail hunting this year at all.
How about sickos?
Sickos are dirt. I mean, they're
I'm still hearing some bugling.
Last Saturday night, I had one come within like 40, 50 feet. I mean, I couldn't see him, but man. You could feel his throat growling, you know, when he was bugling. Mm-hmm. But they're still moving. But you just need some cool weather, man.
Yeah. Everything I'm hearing from hunters is
it didn't stop them, but it helps us.
Yeah, exactly.
And I tell you, the other double whammy right now is mosquitoes, man. Oh my goodness. I ain't shitting you. All right, look,
if you don't have three thermocells, you're behind the
dude. I had two, and I'm like I've been shot by a Daisy Red Ryder BB gun about 100,000 times all over myself. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got that bug tamer, and I pulled the veil. I'm packing up my stuff with the veil hanging down. Yeah, you got to turn, put your little headlight on so it's bright enough you can see through the veil. I mean, they're tough.
Well, Eddie, what do we got coming up? Anything coming up we want to talk about? Anything we need?
I don't know. Our schedule's off since we got screwed up last week.
Well, not just that, but here we've got we were revisiting this whole Snakehead Festival thing and what's going on.
Yeah.
What we're worried about, honestly, is this whole COVID thing and what's going on. You know,
they're starting to shut things back down.
We were 50% for the restaurants the other day, and now they shut us back down to 25%. Which I'm not saying, isn't it?
It's 50 now.
I thought they dropped it to 25. Somebody said today.
Hogan's supposed to go live in about 15 minutes, we'll find out.
Then I heard that's what they're going to do. Right. So I heard that they're probably going to drop at 25%. So if they do that, I think that restaurants are going to be feeling another hit again, man. You know what I mean? And it's really sad because there's got to be ways around this to keep these businesses going, you know? And
vaccine.
Well, the vaccine and
I just don't know what the right answer is for because, I mean, it's you're wrong either way. Right. That's just how it's going to be for a while. So I don't know.
Guess we just have to go with it and see what happens.
Just do the best you can with what you got.
So we haven't forgot about the festival. You know, we're still working on that. I've been talking with MEPS here a little bit lately about the Snakehead box. We're going to get back to that. We're going to start building that, get that ready. Maybe we'll get something going here real soon. We're just real happy to have them involved with the podcast and doing some things. You know, we kind of lost touch with that with the COVID thing, but now we're back in contact with them. Maybe I should, but I talked to a little birdie that they're putting together a fairly large Snakehead tournament on the west side. Not sure where they're going to do it at yet, but I had talked to some of the people over at CCA and that may be in the works. So it may be in the works. That means it's in the works. So that's going on. We're getting ready to come into the colder months. So we're going to have a lot of flea markets, a lot of fishing shows and things like that coming up. We'll try to
good time to restock gear.
We're going to try to promote some of those guys. So if you're out there and you're having a show coming up and
let us know,
maybe we'll you want to come on the podcast and talk about it. You know, we can talk about your show coming up, you know, out there or something like that. We'll help you out.
Absolutely.
I mean, we got a lot of good things going and we're going to keep them going. And we're just grateful to have the support behind us that we do. And, you know, for those of us that are in this campaign, we're fighting as hard as we can to do the right thing. And, you know, if you see something, say something. I'm still going to stay there. I'm not going to get into anything else.
You mentioned it earlier. I will say this. Apparently, the first shot, Blackwater, went very well.
Yes, it went very well. In fact, walking out with my mentee for her first sit, I was going through how, you know, elusive the deer are and how we have to be quiet and, you know, watch everything. And we're walking and I'm like, oh, wait, there's one right there standing there. And it was a little.
Never mind.
It's not usually this easy.
And it's a little, you know, young in the year, sick of Spike. And he's just sitting there staring at us. And I was like, well, there you go. There's our quarry. It's
we don't have to be
there.
Quiet anymore. Sing your songs, dance.
Just what I was talking about.
But it was a very good experience. You know, they saw a lot of deer, even though the conditions weren't necessarily the greatest. It rained the first day, but people did see deer, so that was good. And that's part of, you know, trying to get those folks hooked on hunting. You want them to have a good experience. And so, you know, when you don't necessarily have to harvest a deer, but if you can at least see them or see something cool, you know, the morning that we hunted, there was a fox, you know, running around the berm, and he was doing what foxes do, you know, screaming, you know, every so many minutes, and she just never heard that. So it was kind of a neat experience, you know, just sitting out there sharing the love of wildlife.
How many participants did you guys have in the first shot? Do you know how many was?
I don't know. I could get the numbers for you. Yeah, I don't know. I know in the past it's been in like the 20s, but mm-hmm. I don't know this year.
I think it's really awesome. And for those of you that have not gotten involved with that program, you may want to sign up for the program and check it out. You know what I mean? It's a great way to make an emotional connection with somebody that you don't know and learn
something.
And
if you're a first-timer, you might get Gary as a mentee next year. So.
Oh, God. Yeah. You might not want to apply, folks. No, I'm just kidding.
It's mentee, not mental.
Yeah. Don't worry, I'll Uber you guys if anything goes wrong.
Oh, man.
Any one more?
No, I don't have any one more. So what about you?
Is she going to sing for us?
Only if Marnie's going to sing.
Oh, no.
It's okay. We have a parental advisory sticker on our
Has anybody ever said yes?
Chris Leslie kind of jumped in there a little bit.
Yeah, Chris sang a few verses there.
So I don't want to take away from the experience.
From the magic.
That's what I say all the time.
It's time. It's now. The Sunday Funday Giveaway. Brought to you by Blackwater's Edge and the Crab Stand. Look, you need crabs. You need big crabs. You need heavy crabs. You need absolutely mustard-packed crabs. And you need crabs from the Crab Stand, home of the guaranteed number one Maryland crab. This week I'm going to give away some big jumbos, folks. If you haven't had any big crabs this year, get out to the Crab Stand this weekend, because we're going to have them giant crabs, and we've had crabs up to 8+ inches every weekend. So with that being said, we're going to give away a few crabs, but before I do that, I'm going to sing a little crabby jingle.
You better give away your
crabs. You're right, I better, because last week I didn't do that. So, all right, so here we go. Are you ready? It's now. John O'Mara, I'm going to give you a dozen jumbo crabs. Real deals, we call them. R-E-A-L-D-E-A-L or D-E-A-L-Z. Real deals, right? Still learning how to spell. Molly Herman Kessel. Kapow! I'm going to give you a dozen jumbos too, all right? One more dozen jumbos going out the door. That's over $100 dozen crabs given away this weekend here at Blackwater's Edge. Bobby Scott, you get that last Kapow! Dozen of jumbos. So stop out to the crab stand, either location this weekend, Abingdon or Maryland Line, and pick up your dozen crabs, each of you, and we will make you very happy. But before I go, let me leave you with a little crabby jingle. My crabs, they have three first names. It's Heavy, Full, and Fat. My crabs, they have a fourth name. Absolutely mustard packed! Hey, you better get a whole bag of bulk straws to get all that mustard out this weekend. If you ask me where they're from, they're 100% guaranteed Maryland number ones. At the crab stand, here's a fact. I know for sure you're coming back. Kapow! Kapow! Kapow!